When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to a special bonus, rather than just a regular bonus episode of the Book Riot Podcast. Further afield than we've been of late, with the bonus episodes outside of Rebecca and I doing half-baked ideas about nothing. This was a half-baked idea that y'all came up with. And I think knowing that the bait on this particular hook would not be hard to set on me to talk about the pilot episode of The West Wing, and then maybe The West Wing writ large a little bit, and we've talked about maybe doing some more episodes in the future as double secret bonus episodes at some point as well. I want you guys to talk to me about why we are doing this now. I mean, some of it's obvious, I guess, like, you know, election season, blah, blah, blah. But what's the non-obvious part about why you're talking about The West Wing right now?
Yeah, I think the quick background of, like, Amanda and I spent the last couple months of election season creating what we ended up referring to as the Hope Train, which began with just texting each other, like, good, hopeful news, whether it was polling or, you know, mostly it was polling, let's be honest, about the direction of the election and the direction of politics in the country. And as the election really happened, Amanda spun that out into sort of daily updates on Instagram. And we ended up being like the internet's election moms, I think, where I was doing the, like, everybody take some deep breaths and, like, drink some water and put your feet flat on the floor. And Amanda was like, and here are the statistics. And this is statistically why you should not be that worried. It's all going to be fine. Get on the Hope Train. And as the election ended in our favor, Amanda was able to get out of the cycle that she's been on since the 2016 election of just watching The Office on repeat. Yep. So maybe that's a helpful thing for you to, you can take a minute now and explain why you were watching The Office on repeat.
Because my brain is like a PC from the year 2003. Like, it has to defrag, you know what I mean, occasionally. And I just ran out of space once the 2016 election happened. And I had no room for new media that required emotional or mental buy-in or labor or really even interest for me. So I ended up watching The Office over and over and over for 4 years because it was just all I could tolerate. And admittedly, I'm not a big TV watcher in general. Like, TV for me at night is usually just something that's in the background while I'm doing something else, so whatever. But I couldn't even, like, Great British Baking Show wasn't really happening. Like, it was just all that I could stomach, but I didn't have the brain space for it. So now that our great national nightmare is coming to an end, I have suddenly the ability to watch different television.
Yeah. So shortly after the election, somewhere in that, like, 4 or 5 days after, Amanda texted me that she was going to do a full West Wing rewatch. And I think on Saturday last week when the election was called, I rounded out the day by watching one of my favorite West Wing episodes and then just, like, popping in and out of clips of some of my favorite scenes. And we were just texting about, like, how nice it was to spend time in this space again. And I was like, what if we, like, we're going to talk to each other about the West Wing for the entirety of the time that Amanda's rewatching it and that I'm dipping in and out. So, like, why don't we just record our conversations about it and call it work?
Yeah.
It's nice. It's nice to be king, isn't it? In that regard. Let's talk about your first exposure to the West Wing. You guys are enough younger than me that when this came out, the age difference mattered a lot more. So the pilot debuted in September of 1999, which is really hard to put yourself back in that place of 21-ish years ago. This was the waning days of the Clinton administration, and the show runs through 2006, which is Obama is just elected to Senate in Illinois in 2006. So it's not really, maybe some people had a glimmer of Obama as a candidate, let alone not a two-term beloved president. Here we are on Obama Day, recording on November 17th. 2020.
I was first on the hold list at the library. I got that email that had come in, and I was there 5 minutes later. So it's sitting right next, it's sitting right next to me.
I think it's fascinating to think about how the West Wing informed the political hearts of many of our generation and political persuasion, even up to and including how we thought about and romanticized the Obama administration to some degree. I think, you know, Obama and Michelle and Barack, I should say, Obama are so polished, and Rebecca and I have talked about this a lot, that we never really feel like we get a sense of them, except that they're giving a sense that they want to give us of them, right? There's no, like, cracks in the, there's no leaks in their game of what they're telling us. And I think I found myself filling in the blanks, inserting the frog DNA into the dinosaur DNA, to use a Jurassic Park reference, of the Obama White House, using West Wing DNA, that if I do, I sort of like have just imposed it on there. And I think it's informed for ways that are both understandable and bad, but also maybe romantic and idealistic at the same time, how I hope think about what goes on in the minds of political people that I share an affiliation with. And I think the pilot really brings that home to bear in a lot of ways that are comfortable and uncomfortable to me, I should say. And I was, when this came out, I was a senior in college, 21 years old, getting ready. I was in the active process of applying to graduate students as a liberal arts major. And I told Rebecca, this was a very bad time for someone like me, a white dude who fancied himself with vaguely literary aspirations, to watch a show about white people who know things that other people don't. Very tough for me. And I was inclined, for a lot of reasons that are cultural and personal, to take that particular pill. And I think in hindsight, I understand, and it was inevitable, and you could have taken worse pills, and some of those pills would have been literal pills, I guess, in some ways. But I don't know. The weight of it is sufficiently heavy, but also I feel like I sloughed off a lot of the West Wing. So to watch the pilot again, especially, I felt a little bit like going back to my childhood bedroom of like, oh yeah, but also this bed is too small, you know, and these clothes don't fit. And like, it's comforting, but it's foreign at the same time. So that's my West, and Michelle and I, my partner Michelle, we've watched a lot of it over time. We have our favorites. I think in a lot of ways the characters have become mythical in this regard, which is we can refer to them as archetypes and, you know, and that sort of a thing. So that's where it is in my life. Let's go reverse order again. Amanda, you start with where, how did you did you first encounter it when it came out? Because you would have been a legit middle schooler or something like that, right?
In 1999, I was a freshman in high school, so... my family did not have a lot of money. We didn't have cable or really watch television, so I did not watch The West Wing as it came out. I was also, I am not a lifelong liberal. I was very conservative as a, I guess, teenager and then as a young adult until probably my mid-20s. So The West Wing was very much like not interesting to me, even after I moved out of my parents' house. I mean, at that point, it had been on for several seasons. Like, you don't jump into a show midstream anyway, so I probably wouldn't have decided to anyway.
Well, back in those days, you couldn't binge watch or a marathon.
Right, exactly.
You would have to do it in reruns or something. Get the cassette. I don't even know how you would have done it.
And the exact things that were appealing to you about it made me very angry. Like, this is a kind of, I mean, I don't think I can say, how do I put this? It's not like a gross way. This is a self-aggrandizing Aaron Sorkin monument to his own brain for rich white people who think they're smarter than me because I'm from the country. So like, I was not into it. So I first watched it after my political affiliation changed and I got a little bit older and like less of a jerk. And not that Republicans are a jerk. I was a jerk. And so don't email me because I'm not going to read it.
I've seen the list of books she required you to have read in order to be her friend in high school. I can confirm
it's super long.
Probably a jerk.
Very long.
Amanda, someday when we have a DeLorean, we'll go back and we'll decide which of us was more insufferable at 16. Because it is going to be super close.
That would be really hard. So I started watching it like when it came out on Netflix, and I was in this moment of my life of like, oh, I missed that. Like, that was a moment, you know, and I missed a cultural moment. So I'm going to watch it. And then now when I'm an insufferable liberal, before when I was an insufferable conservative, of course, I love it.
Yeah. So, Rebecca, you're probably in the middle then between Amanda and I in that regard.
Right. I was a junior in high school in 1999, and I think I was aware that the West Wing like existed, but also I grew up in the suburbs in a relatively conservative situation, and my parents weren't watching the West Wing, and I was not like politically active at the time. So I didn't watch it. Nobody in my household was watching it live. And then I went to college and wasn't watching TV because I was doing college things. So I watched it the first time also on Netflix. I think the first time that I watched it through was 9-ish years ago. Mm. Like in the one of the ways that it was formative for me is that the early years of Book Riot and my first watching of The West Wing overlapped with each other, and the sense of like the camaraderie of these people, like being like the camaraderie and the friendships and sort of the culture of like real care that they all have for each other, but also like everyone is very direct about things. Overlapped with the development of like being up at like 1 a.m. finishing a post for Book Riot, and that like sense that the few of us that were around at the very beginning were like sort of in this like little contained world together fighting to like do a thing that we really believed in and wanted to have work. So like that was such an interesting way to experience it the first time. And then I rewatched the whole thing a couple years after that. And a couple years ago, I like early in the Trump administration, I thought, oh, maybe watching The West Wing will like be comforting.
No, don't do that.
Yeah,
I tried
it wasn't.
That before I landed on the show.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I made it through maybe the first season or the first and second seasons. I didn't make it very far. I got through the Shibboleth episode. I remember.
That's a favorite.
Yeah. And then it was not helping. It was just making me long even more for this kind of decency and intelligence in politics. So I gave it up. I'm not on board for the whole rewatch right now. Like I don't know if I'm going to do the whole thing ever again. Who knows what time will do, but I'm excited to go back through some of my favorite episodes and the touchstone moments, I think, that I think of. And I think you're right, Jeff, that the characters become archetypes. Like in the text exchange that Amanda and I were having last week about getting ready to do this, we were slotting our coworkers into the characters of The West Wing.
I'm Josh, if anyone's curious.
So much so contemporaneous with Sex and the City, and everyone was doing which Sex and the City person are you. I was always more of the which West Wing person are you. That was much more for a variety of reasons that are both expected and gross and weird and sexist at the same time, but like that's where my brain was, is like, do which of these people would I want to be? Which of them am I not? Which of them do you want to look up to? I mean, we have, it's not even an elephant in the room. I think we just talk about the endemic sexism of most Sorkin of the early days, especially that still exists. And then the near total whitewashing of America that happens here. I watch it with a different eye than I'd ever watched the pilot before. Actually, I don't watch the pilot that often. I don't like it for a lot of reasons I think we can talk about. But the first person of color is Leo's maid in the background, which I never noticed because I've never watched on a big enough TV that I did now to see in the background. We get some black people in like the Roosevelt room around the table. And we get Kathy, who's Asian American, who is Sam's assistant. We don't even have Charlie yet, notably.
Right.
We don't have a lot of the people that I think maybe make the show even better than it is. I think we get the core of it. But the lens of race and sexuality, there's some low-key homophobia that happens in a particular conversation too, were unfortunately of its time for liberal Democrats like me. I'll say that, I guess.
And it's still more diverse than the Trump administration was.
Well, even I think that's a great point. And even then, I think it was more diverse than the Clinton administration. Like, it was more aspirational in ways that even the liberal Democrat in office weren't at the same time.
My 2020 lens on the pilot was, this is such an interesting mix of ideas that are still really progressive or relatively progressive today. Like, Sam, and now just to jump into plot, like Sam being fine with the fact that the woman he went home with turns out to be a sex worker.
Right.
Like that, you know, other than worried about what's going to happen.
Only a PR problem,
career,
not a personal moral
problem. Right. It's only a PR problem. It's not a personal issue. And like they're, you know, she's doing wake and bake. Like there's some very progressive stuff, especially for 1999, that Sorkin is like trying to normalize. And then there is also the this is water stuff of just endemic sexism and whitewashing of everything, really, but whitewashing of what America looked like at the time. But I can't remember if it was on a Slack group that we have with some friends, or if it was a direct text to Amanda that I was like, I'm watching this and it's 1999 and this White House is more diverse than the Trump administration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because later we get Fitz and McNally, right, who add people of color to the Situation Room, which I think until Condoleezza Rice, as National Security Advisor, was not common. And that's in the Bush administration, of course. And I think contextualizing that way really matters, because at the time it felt romantic, like in a way that Star Trek is romantic, where now it feels romantic in a way like the Back to the Future scenes in the 50s feel romantic, right? Like it's weird to see it from the other side of that romanticism meridian, event horizon.
And there's some, you know, like Manic Pixie Press Girl stuff to the way that CJ is, like CJ's the only high-powered woman in the cast, you know, high up in the administration here, and she has the press job, you know, to go out and do jazz hands and make everything smoothed over and deliver the message job. And I think a 2020 redo of this would have women and people of color, and ideally women of color, having some of the serious policy-driven jobs as well.
The press secretary is the emotional labor piece of the White House, as it's presented here, very 100%. Much so. I think it's telling in the course of the show that eventually CJ takes on Leo's role. And Leo's role throughout the show, I think, is really, I mean, the pedestal of competence. Like, Leo is the person who, you know, Bartlett, he's the one that manages and knows and figures out all the other cats that need herding. Amanda, I'd be curious to hear your reaction, both as your first go round as a newly converted to the blue side, but also on rewatch. Like, I found myself able to compartmentalize the stuff that feels retrograde. I wonder, are you able to do it? To what degree are you able to do it? And what if anything leaks through that you can't sort of say it was of its time and blah blah blah? What can't you put in the that was the best they knew box?
It's so, like, Aaron Sorkin's personal lipstick feminism is so evident from the jump, and I can't, like, not see it, even if it was of its time or whatever. But it's especially evident in the way that CJ is sidelined by the male characters on the show, like, constantly. It's not just in the pilot, but, like, pretty much until she becomes the chief of staff. She's constantly having to fight to be in the room and to be recognized and to be respected. Like, I don't remember if it's in the pilot, but that when she gets into that spitting match with Josh and he calls her a shiksa feminista, it's like, well, that's... Yep. Like, I feel like Aaron Sorkin is writing that. He's having that authorial moment when you're yelling at someone in your real life who you hate and, like, you wish you could have said a thing to them. Like, who in Aaron Sorkin's life is the shiksa feminista that he's, like, screaming about right now? Also, the way that Mary Marsh is portrayed, I thought was really interesting. Mm. Right. You only get to be a hard ass if you're a woman and a Republican. Like, only if you're the enemy do you get to be, because Ainsley, who you know, comes later in the show, who is a Republican and works for the White House, is beautiful and sweet and Southern and genteel, but, like, Mary is this real tough as nails kind of character, and she is obviously a villain,
right? Abby in a real way, do we get the someone who is given the chance to stand up and say, Jed, you're full of shit, right? Which is one of the reasons she's such a breath of fresh air. And then Amy Gardner later. Amy Gardner.
You would not is, Amy Gardner.
is, it, it doesn't, it takes a while. It's not there from the beginning. And Moira Kelly, I guess, is supposed to be able to hit with them, but she just can't for whatever reason. I think the dialogue's there, but there's something about... And again, tellingly, she leaves the show and is never mentioned again, even what happened to Moira. But she can't do it for whatever reason, I guess.
I think this speaks to the Sorkin problem also. I don't know that... I do. I don't think they set Moira Kelly up to have success. Fair. First of all, she has, like... She enters the show in what looks like a scene from Clueless with the top down on her convertible and that beret on her head.
What was that?
And, like, somehow is getting pulled over. Yeah, and, like, she's getting pulled over, and she's not going to hang up her phone, and then she's working for the senator that she's dating. Like her authority, her authority is undermined here from the get-go in multiple ways. Like I think CJ comes across very serious and Sorkin wants us to take her seriously, but we don't get a woman that demands to be taken seriously and gets to be like not a villain like Mary Marsh until we get Abby and Amy Gardner. That you can be a hard ass and, like, for lack of a better term, hot at the same time.
And they almost do it, right? Because the first, you know, Josh is telling Leo, you know, basically introducing that she's going to be Lloyd Russell's, I guess, campaign manager. We're not really sure. But in that conversation, they recognize her as the best of breed, sort of for what she does outside of Lyman. But then they undercut that in the diner scene where it's like, you're dating Lloyd Russell. Like, you didn't have to do that. And I understand that structurally, what I think Sorkin was trying to do was give Josh a sparring partner, right? Someone that could come in and be a foil on the left, right, for what the Bartlett administration was doing. But to see how Sorkin deployed that is telling, right? I think to Amanda's point, like, or Rebecca's point, that he couldn't quite not see her as a sexual object, or not quite, couldn't at all, frankly. Like, and even CJ, her introduction, she's hitting on a guy awkwardly
at
the gym.
Hitting on the guy on the treadmill.
Yeah, like he can't pass the Bechdel test even when the women are talking to men.
That's right. I'm talking to you about talking to you. That's how badly they can't. It doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Now, having said all that, or should we do airing of grievances? Is there anything else we want to get before we talk about what it is we talk about the West Wing, like the thing that we hold in our hearts that incites us to watch it again and talk about it again? What else do we need to talk about here before we talk about what it is that we like? What is it that we carry forward? Anything?
Grievances. I really dislike Sam. And the more I watch it, the less I like him. And it irritates me that he's set up to run for president someday because he's awful.
It was never clear to me, because Jed says in that HBO Max one, right, where he's playing chess, you're going to run for president someday. I was like, really? It's Sam? I always like Sam. But like Sam, I was like...
Is it because he's pretty? Like why?
It must be. It must be because he's pretty. Sam is sex object is a grad school essay I would read.
Yeah. It's, you know, he is the slick, like image focused one. Like Josh can't be relied on to go on TV and not fly off the handle. Yeah.
Right.
But can we have a moment for how well the phrase, the God you pray to is too busy being indicted for tax fraud, has aged into 2020?
Unbelievable.
That whole interaction. That whole, like, subplot, I just...
Yeah. I guess that's the other part of romanticism, right, is wish fulfillment of the things you wish people actually did and said in public, in political life, especially if you have a particular persuasion, that not only that you say them, but that the punches actually land. I think that's one of the big wish fulfillment parts of the West Wing is you say the thing that you think you want to say on Twitter, and then you say it, and actually it works. It changes someone's mind. The biggest naivete here is that you can persuade people through language gymnastics. Like Sorkin word magic can turn people around on stuff, which I want to believe as a language person, but also through bitter tears have learned the limits of that particular mode of
politicking. And it's so interesting
that
when Josh is like, or not Josh, when Leo is talking to Josh about this situation and he says something like, Josh, we need these people.
Yeah.
It's so funny to think about now because the Democratic Party in zero ways needs the evangelical Christian community and has somehow even set it up as like, that's almost the division in the country right now. It's not necessarily the GOP versus the DNC. It's the DNC versus evangelical America. And the idea that a Democrat would go on TV and get into any kind of trouble for saying shit about evangelicals is nonsense right now. And it's so weird.
Yeah. I do, for all the romanticism around it, I do like the moments where Sorkin seems to have like some self-awareness about that there are problems on the side of Democrats as well. And I love the moment where Leo is walking with Caldwell,
Caldwell.
Al Caldwell says, every group has plenty of demons. And Leo says, you don't have to tell me, Reverend, I'm a member of the Democratic Party.
It's hard to remember now, though, that in 1999, at the end of the Clinton administration, for reasons that were legitimate and some that weren't, the Democratic Clinton White House was seen as a pit of villainy between what we now, I think, especially I will say, know to be sexual misconduct. On the part of President Clinton. And then all the other, his whatever, extramarital affairs, philandering, whatever you say he did. But then there was also other stuff within the White. I mean, again, it's politics, so no one is clean. We saw in Primary Colors, I think, came out around a little bit later. It's hard to remember now that at this point, Bush coming in 2000 was seen as draining the swamp, right? Mm. And this was the American president in the West Wing was seen as sort of, what if we could just flush out the gutters of Democratic politics as we see it? What would you be remained with? Well, you'd be remained with a PhD from Wisconsin, who's a family man, who a breath, not only is there no breath of sexual impropriety around Jed Bartlett, but his sexual relationship with Abby over time is highlighted over and over again. To take away any suspicion of what sort of the miasma of Clintonian infidelity, title.
There's a phrase.
So I think that's hard to remember now, of how much it was on the Democratic side, not sort of wish fulfillment about what if the Republicans win our charge, but what if we did it right in the Clinton White House, or how could have we done it better right to some degree? Which do you guys feel that at all now, or is it all through the lens of Obama and Trump at this point when you're watching it?
I was too young for the Clinton administration.
It
figured into my like cultural experience as being aware of what was happening in the Clinton White House, but I wasn't an adult when it was happening, and I wasn't thinking about politics in that way. So I had not watched Sorkin through that lens of commentary on the Clinton White House, which of course it was at the time, or wish fulfillment about what if it had been done right. It's an interesting way to think about it. It was nice to see, and I think this puts me on the hope train, mostly civil interactions between people across the aisles. Like the actual meeting that they have with Mary Marsh and Al Caldwell does not go well because it, like, shockingly, she is anti-Semitic. And they yell at each other, but there's a good moment of anybody willing to step, when Josh is apologizing, anybody willing to step up and debate ideas deserves better than a political punchline. And like, I would like to live in that world. Yeah. Like, I would like to live in the world where Democrats and Republicans and people from other parties are actually just talking about ideas and debating the best solutions to the problems that this country faces, rather than shouting each other down and calling each other names, which, as we've seen for the last 4 years, is not productive on either side. So that was that's what wish fulfillment in this episode feels like to me the most, is what if we could be in that place, and can we get back to a place that resembles something of like actually trying to find solutions and some sort of coalition building, and not this obsessive divisiveness.
The where I am right now is Dunk City USA on Republicans every time I could ever think of doing it, and it was I did find that scene meaningful too, because they do have respect for Al Caldwell, who is sort of a Billy Graham-ish kind of figure, I think, is supposed to be to some degree. And even later in other series of the show, Sorkin, and then later Tommy Shalhoub and other people who took over for Sorkin, try to find moments. Maybe the biggest wish fulfillment one is the William Fichtner, Glenn Close double Supreme Court nomination. Which, no, but also I get what you're trying to do in that moment. But like they do hold some space, more than my generosity probably would allow in this moment, to hear a good faith counter to some kind of position, which I'm going to try to take to bear to some point too. The thing that struck me, Rebecca, about Toby coming back there is that and I think this is also such, when you've worked with other people for a long time and done those things where you have hard things to do, there are moments where you try to compromise, like he's trying to get him on the show and do the thing to apologize. Mm-hmm. But then to recognize when there is a line that cannot be crossed, right? That was a part I was especially appreciative of. It's not all compromise, and it's not all righteous indignation, that you will give and give and give until you can't give anymore. And I think that's the other part of the discourse you're asking for, is not just, I don't want to have all lines and sands. If we're all behind lines and sands, we can't get anywhere. But also, we can't all be marshmallows and like give up and say, yes, you're right, and I'm so sorry. Like, there's got to be some I don't know. Some resistance, well, but also an iron core, but it's also not all spikes at the same time, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's fundamentally, there's that meeting that they're having with Mary Marsh and Al Caldwell is fundamentally about accountability.
Yeah.
And they go into it thinking that it's about Josh being accountable for the way that he behaved on the show and that he needs to apologize because what they were supposed to be doing is having a debate and discussing ideas, and he made it personal. Mm-hmm. And then when it becomes clear that Mary Marsh is making it personal and in a really gross way, she has violated, like, she's violated the terms of a good faith conversation. And you're right, Toby won't stand for it, and he's not empowered to auction off the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And then it becomes about holding them accountable. Right. And once the president enters and he says, you know, we're not gonna talk about anything, Al, until you disavow the lambs of God and you separate yourself from these extreme Christian groups that are doing literal violence and harm, like, that's accountability also. And I do think that's part of it. Like, it's not just compromise and squishiness. Like, we're not gonna hold hands and sing Kumbaya, but maybe we could all, like, stand in the same room together and have a conversation and just be accountable for doing things in a good faith effort and holding each other to it.
Yeah, I think that scene has, even just the idea that they would be in a room together.
Right.
First of all, the idea that they would be invited to the White House. If it were all the other way around, like if someone from the in any of the instances where this has actually happened in the last 4 years, when one of the members of the Trump administration has said something god-awful to any, you know, other civilian member of the country, they don't get invited to the White House for a make good, like, or a peace offering. That doesn't happen. So
No. Even
just that was like, oh, that's kind of, that's nice.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. That was nice. But then the recognition that their belief system, when Bartlett comes in and is like, hi, this is, like, real cute, but you're affiliated with these horrible monster people, get out of my White House. That was very satisfying to me, because I'm in the same place where Rebecca is, where I think a lot of people are right now, where, like, we have to come to grips with the fact that 70 million people voted for Donald Trump. Like, the DNC has to do something with that information. We can't just sit here behind our wall of self-righteousness and act like we are, you know, correct about everything and everyone else is evil and that's the end of the story. If that's the end of the story, then we lose every election moving forward. Like, we've got to figure something out. However, there is a point at which you have done actual harm. Get the hell out of my White House. Like, that also has to be true. And the DNC has never figured out a good way to thread that needle. And I think that watching Jeb Bartlett kind of throw the needle out the window just feels real nice.
Yeah, the moment where he's like, also, you don't even know what the First Amendment or the First Amendment
I am the Lord your God.
We're going to do a quick sponsor break and we'll come back, because we should pick up there for a second. Bartlett. Let's talk about Bartlett.
I think Bartlett holds up great, frankly.
All things considered, Bartlett holds up great.
I think so. And the watching his speech at the end, you know, when they've gathered everybody in the Oval for that first big ensemble shot in the Oval Office, and those moments that I think we come to love over the series, and he's doing with the clothes on their back, they came through a storm, and the ones that didn't die, like, watching that kind of presidency and then living through 8 years of an Obama presidency with a president who is a wonderful orator and a powerful speaker, was like, watching Bartlett do that rang some of those Obama bells. And then I started wondering in what ways attachment to Bartlett as a president and a speaker like that set up the left to, you know, there are a million good reasons to have voted for Barack Obama, and they're not all connected to the fact that he's a great speaker. But I wondered what that, like, it must have felt familiar in some ways if you had watched The West Wing and watched Bartlett do that for years, or watched Martin Sheen perform that character that way for years, then watching a candidate and then later a president who was a polymath in those same ways and could speak intelligently on tons of topics and weave them all together into something that's not just smart, but beautiful and compelling. It must have felt familiar.
I have complicated feelings about Bartlett.
Yeah, go.
I love him, whatever. And I do think that he holds up. My complication is with this kind of the archetype of Bartlett, this idea that His doctor, the one who dies, is it in the pilot when he dies or the first few episodes?
It's shortly thereafter. It's, yeah, it's quick after.
Who calls him, he makes an offhanded comment of like, sir, you're a once in a generation mind, just let them get to know you. And that's the kind of the through line of the whole show, yeah, is that Bartlett and then eventually Sam are these super geniuses, and that is what qualifies them for the presidency. But in reality, that can't stand on its own. And you know, we had Woodrow Wilson, who was a super genius, but who also spent most of his time in the White House writing fan fiction about the Klan. Like, being a once in a generation mind can only take a presidency so far. And Bartlett has the other elements, right? Like, he's got great character. He actually has compassion. He cares about people. He's not a racist. It's handy. All of those things. But I don't know. The fact that they just keep hammering on what a genius he is through the whole show.
Well, what a genius everyone is. There's no bigger credential dropper in the history of popular entertainment than Aaron Sorkin. Who cares if Josh Lyman's a Fulbright scholar? We all went to Harvard. We all edited the Law Review. We all were Rhodes Scholars. We all were National Merit Scholars. We're talking about our SAT scores. You know, and this is coming from someone who has, at various points, been super conscious about that stuff. That's maybe the most insufferable idiosyncrasy, because I don't actually think it matters, but the fetishization of accomplishment and credential is the kind of thing that a, you know, homespun, white working, whatever phrase you want to use, would rightly be furious about. I think would rightly be furious about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I do think it... I think the concerns that they have about how smart Bartlett is and how to present that and how, like, how smart is he allowed to be for it to still be palatable and relatable and for him to be electable? Yeah. Like, I think that still feels very relevant, and it feels like a foreshadowing of the conversations that we've been having to hear for the last, like, really 6 years, since about, you know, 2014, when campaigning kind of started for the 2016 election, that aim to paint educated people as out of touch, and that aim to paint educated people as unable to relate to less educated people, or attempting to divide coastal elites from people who live in flyover country, and make them feel like you can't use your big words here. You couldn't possibly understand what life is like. And I do think that's I hate that it is a thing that we have to be concerned about on the left, but I think it's a very real concern with who's electable. And I think, like, sexism was a huge part of what happened in 2016. And not to mention the fact that Hillary won the popular vote by more than 3 million votes, but she was so smart. And that's scary for a lot of people. And I don't think it's an accident that the strategically best decision for the DNC going into this election was to run somebody who has a pretty strong dose of Uncle Fluffy, as they call, you know, as the staff later referred to, like, one of Bartlett's folksier
personas
moments. Right. Like, I think Joe Biden's a really smart guy and has a lot of great experience, but he's not giving the kind of speeches that Jed Bartlett gives, or the kind of speeches that Barack Obama gave, that are attractive to a highbrow kind of audience, and therefore can make other kinds of audiences feel excluded or like they're being pushed aside. I agree, Amanda, that the presentation of, like, you're a super genius and that's why you're the president is a problem. I think the way they tangle with how to make him approachable is really interesting.
Because you don't need to say that Bartlett's won the Nobel Prize for Economics, that he's smart, when he gives spontaneous speeches like he does. Like, let the words do the work. Like, Sorkin, there's a lot about the pilot, I think, that Sorkin doesn't yet trust what he can do with language alone, how fast it is, how much movement there is, like, how many jokes there are. Like, the spontaneous oration Bartlett gives is enough for us to know that Bartlett is smart. We don't actually be told that he's smart. I mean, talk about Manic Pixie Dream Girls. So he's a grandmaster at chess. He's got a Nobel Prize in economics. I guess great in the sack, we're supposed to be told. There is nothing he can't do. He's like Superman, right? This is what if Superman of brains was in the White House? But the way that Sorkin's and liberal democratic politics of the time and even today still work is, the same blindness that makes this all white people is the same one that doesn't understand how credentials and whiteness and privilege go together, right? All this fetishization of credentials, if that's what you do, if that's how you keep score, at this particular moment and still now, of course there aren't going to be any black people or Latinos or transgender because they don't get those kind of credentials for a whole bunch of bullshit reasons. So like, I think those things go together at the same time. I think it's a mistake for me, frankly, to not connect one thing I hate about the show with another thing that I'm trying to compartmentalize about the show, right? And say, well, that was just the time.
Yeah, there's that line that CJ says to him when they're joking about why he lost Texas.
Yeah.
And she said, and he says, "Do you know why we lost? Do you know when we lost Texas?" And she said, "Is it when you learned to speak Latin?" It's in the post hoc ergo proctor hoc episode. And that, I remember the first time I heard that and was like, "Oh yeah, that's exactly what would make somebody lose when you learn to speak Latin." And it's not necessarily, I mean, speaking as like a former conservative from rural America, right, it's not that smart people shouldn't be in office. It's like Jeff was saying, like the way that they condescend
to
everyone else.
The condescension, that's the right word exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, to be frank, I mean, along with racism and class, like all the kind of things that got us Donald Trump, I think a big part of it is the way that rural conservatives feel condescended to by liberals in their like self-righteous Ivy League, Jeb Bartlett, grandmaster at chess kind of attitudes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fair. One or more sponsor break while we're in the middle of it. And I kind of want to do character by character power rankings, both for this episode and the series. So it sounds like Amanda, Sam fell down. Maybe from the beginning of your experience of the West Wing, he was down towards the bottom. Who's towards the top? And it doesn't have to be, it could be in this pilot, but also as we reconsider the West Wing writ large, who's at the top of your power rankings here?
Josh is my favorite character because I am Josh.
Talk about that. Josh's centrality to the pilot and also I think his centrality to the whole series is something I had grokked but not intellectualized until now, I think, actually, for a lot of, like, the stakes here are Josh going to keep his job. The most interesting romantic relationship is Josh and Donna going forward. He's at the center in a lot of different ways. So talk about Josh.
Well, speaking just from the pilot, he is one of the only characters who allows himself to be glib to everyone. Like, he talks to Leo in the same way that he talks to CJ, in the same way that he talks to Toby. Like, he does idolize Leo, it's obvious from the jump, and also Bartlett, as every character does. But he has to put on his big boy pants, and you can see him doing it. Like, you can see the actor putting on his big boy pants to be like, oh, I have to talk like an adult to the president now. And I think he takes himself the least seriously while also being the most egotistical of all the characters, which, like, hashtag relatable content for me.
Also
personally,
probably the most self-conscious about, he may not be as smart as Toby and Sam. I don't know why he thinks
which
that.
He's probably not. And like,
probably. And Amy Gardner too, frankly. One of
Well,
and there, if anybody here is most likely to go on TV and insult the opposition,
it's absolutely
it's
me. Yes, of course it is. Like, of course it is. And then to sit in the room and laugh while everyone else like comes to my defense, I would absolutely do that when he's like, I didn't even have to say anything. Like, yes, that is exactly what I would do. But then, I mean, later in the show, Charlie becomes my favorite character. Just the way that he manages with a capital M every single person in that White House, every single person. And they never know what's happening. And he always does it with like the, he's just so slick. Like, he's a genius. He's a super genius.
The Charlie moments in the Hartsfield's Landing episode, because Amanda and I watched that live, the live version of it on HBO Max on election night, where he's making CJ check out the president's schedule for the day. And there are just such great one-liners where he clearly, like, he's just in charge in that way that often there is somebody in power who has like an administrative assistant or they're a person who manages all their shit. And that's the person who's really in control of like where all the things are in any given day.
Yeah, it's Charlie's mastery of the domain is such that when someone challenges his knowledge of their domain, like CJ does, it's a wipeout, right? Like, he's such a master of the inner workings of the physical space of the White House and what it means to move people in and around it, around the president, that people don't see happening, right? Fantastic stuff. Rebecca, who fell? Who was an underwhelming revisit and who was maybe overwhelming?
I'm always underwhelmed and like sad by how CJ is in the opening episodes of the show. Yeah. And I love how her character develops, but I think CJ is low in the power rankings on the pilot. And then Leo comes in high for me, like through the whole series, and I think there's some identification stuff going on there too. Like, there's a lot of Leo in me, maybe. Like, I would 100% call the paper because they spelled Gaddafi's name wrong in the crossword puzzle. And I also really love Toby and the tension that exists between Toby and Leo, and Toby's like wanting it to be right and wanting to like think through all the things is a thing that I love and I'm drawn to in a person, but can also drive me nuts. And I want the like, Jeff, is this feeling familiar? and I relate to the Leo. Okay, that's great. But at some point we have to like stop thinking about it and like do the thing. And maybe the thing involves a lot of compromise.
Yeah.
And how I really admire how that character is written to see all the people that are in the room and the team that's been assembled and sort of get the best out of everybody. I'm really like, I think that's what's aspirational to me about that character, and what's aspirational in how I want to think about myself is like, who are the people that are around me, and what's the language we use about management? Like, how do you help people find the best and highest use of themselves?
Right. Yeah.
And I love it about Leo.
Interesting. My falling the rankings, I'm along with Sam in this regard. I think I overestimate, or I think Rob Lowe does more with Sam. Like, his performance of Sam is really wonderful. Like, he gets something about the essential nerdiness and attraction. You know, the seductiveness and nerdiness of the Sorkin milieu is best expressed in Sam. But there's nothing that Sam does that Toby can't do, I guess, ultimately, when it comes right down to it in mind. There's nothing that Sam does that Josh can't do. He's just another person to say Sorkin words, right? And anything that Sam is given to him by Rob Lowe and not necessarily the writing itself. For me, this may come as a surprise to no one here, especially. I am probably most like Toby being mad on the plane about my phone getting in the way of the plane when I've already read the documentation about the plane I'm on. Like, I feel like that's a version of me that I am more than I would like to admit.
I feel like,
but
if
then
you
there's,
text
and then,
me
but of course, then everyone
flight,
also wants to be Jed, who comes in, opens the doors, and reframes the discussion in a way that gets everyone to see everything in his way, and everyone then shuts up and goes home and let me sit around in my sweatsuit in my office. Like, I think those are the yin and the yang of how I would like to be versus how I, in my best moments, I can be clarifying. In my worst moments, I can be Robert's Rules of Order and Did You Know? And why can't we do the thing? I want to do this because I know more about this one detail that I'm saying matters when it really doesn't at this particular moment. I should just close my phone. Right. I'm not special. Close your phone.
If we're going to talk about aspirational.
Yeah.
I know that I am Josh Lyman and my aspirational character is Leo. Because
Leo.
Say
more about that, Amanda.
Well, because Leo is Josh with a muzzle, like with a filter.
And that's
a
good.
Functional.
You're thinking that's good, though. You think that's
yes,
good.
Yes, he has a functional.
See, I don't know
well,
that that's
a
good.
Functional because he gets to be the chief of staff. Like, Josh becomes the chief of staff at the end of the show with a different president after he has learned to shut up for 8 years, right? And then he becomes the chief of staff when he finally figures out how to, like, have a romantic relationship and maybe keep your mouth shut every now and then. Like, just every now and then, you know, and starts to actually care about how the things that he says makes other people feel. And Leo is masterful at that, while at the same time managing to get all of the things done. Josh does not care who he bulldozes, which I frequently do not care who I bulldoze to get to where I think I need to be. And Leo has the same thing, but, like, he cares from the beginning of the show about who he's bulldozing.
I don't want to say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. I've come to see Leo as sort of toothless. He
Oh, really?
He is the domesticated version of Stockard Channing's best qualities, of Jed's best qualities, of Toby's best qualities, even of CJ's best qualities, though she's not given as much free rein. He is the guy you go to when you need to just get through something, which is super valuable.
That Jed muzzles him, right? Like, they have that conversation.
I don't believe that for a second. I never have believed that moment. I know exactly what you're talking about, and you're totally right. I guess I never felt that. Like, when's Leo ever like righteous indignation, right? You know, spontaneous eloquence that convinces someone. He does it, but it's always in the form of like, instrumental reason rather
than... No, he doesn't do the spontaneous eloquence, which I also don't do. And like, he brings people into his office and calmly threatens them until they do what he says, and then they leave and he does the crossword puzzle. Like, that's Leo's power move.
Yeah, I think we're telling on ourselves, Amanda. You and I are telling ourselves real hard right now, which is fine.
Well, like, look, if we're going to introduce Abby and Amy Gardner into power rankings, then I will happily say that Leo falls toothless relative to both of...
Most of the characters do, yeah, to the two of them.
Amy Gardner as chief of staff in the Bartlett White House is something I always wanted. I just to see the different mixology, because she gets to be spiky and competent and put pieces together in a way. That's super fun. Where else you want to go? Where else you want to go with this? We got 5 minutes.
I love the mix, I think through the whole series, I love the mixture of reverence and humor that they have about the president, that, you know, he was swerving to avoid a tree. He was unsuccessful. And that Mrs. Landingham. Yeah. And when Leo and Mrs. Landingham are in the Oval Office and Leo's like, he's a klutz, your president is a geek. And Mrs. Landingham is like,
not in the
you
Oval
can
Office.
Only you cannot say that in this room. You know, like, there's real reverence for the office of the presidency, which is something I'm looking forward to seeing come back to the world on January 20th.
Yes.
But also a real acknowledgement that this person is a human. And I think that For all of the problems that we've talked about with the way that Sorkin writes really romanticized characters, that's something that I'm really down with for this entire run, is let us have reverence for what this office is and bear in mind forever and ever that the person in the office is a person and that we get to see Jed Bartlett do ridiculous things. Jed Bartlett has a code word for when he's going to go have sex with his wife. He makes mistakes and has to apologize to people at points. He gets held accountable as well.
He also lies to the country about his health for
right. Yeah, like it's a huge human fallibility that comes into it. And I appreciated that mixture of take it seriously, like take the work seriously, but not the people too seriously.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons why I couldn't get on board with rewatching it in 2016. The first time I tried was the reverence is so obvious in the pilot. And it was so obvious in like the pilot of the season of the Trump show in America, that we were getting none of that, that there was no respect for the office. There was no respect for the off literal or figurative of the president. And there was no respect for the government or the American experiment or any of these things that I really value and that so many people in the country really value. So I couldn't, like, the juxtaposition was too much. It was too much in 2016, but now it's like, yeah, we can have that again. Isn't that amazing? Like, that's really nice.
I've got two weird notes that kind of connect to something both of you said. One is the reverence. The way they light the West Wing, like a cathedral, like a shrine. Like, there's one shot, I'm not joking, I counted 14 lamps in the shot. They just, I don't know why. I mean, I know what they're going for.
I love that you counted the lamps.
I mean, look, you got to do what you got to do. But the way that it's lit and the way the space is put together, it's kind of like the catacombs under a cathedral, right? Like, it makes me think of, and then the actual cathedral itself is when you get up into the Capitol building and into the, you know, the halls of Congress. The other thing, and it's not here, it's not in the pilot at all, but it got me thinking about the characters and how eventually we get to know the characters more and their backstories and their complications and relationships. The daddy issues in this show are unbelievable. You can go, Josh Lyman's dad dies during the campaign and there's a scene with Jed. Jed's relationship to his father is a thing throughout the whole thing. Toby's father is a member of the Jewish mafia of Murder Incorporated. CJ's dad gets Alzheimer's. Like, it's on and on. Sam's dad has an affair one of the really great episodes I think Amanda put on, someone's going to emergency, someone's going to jail. His dad has problems. Leo's dad, we get told, is, you know, kind of a good old boy with all that comes in. Charlie doesn't have a dad, or he has one, but it's not a character. And then his mom is, you know, we enter the show where his mom has been killed in the line as a police officer. And it gives a lot of space to think about, like, what are they all dealing with, right? And I don't want to be too Oedipal because that's bad, but, like, it can't be a coincidence that every single person has a daddy issue, right? And I don't know why that is, but it really is striking that even Bartlett himself, who is a substitute father for all of them, himself is looking a substitute father, and he can never get it. And that's like kind of the show. I couldn't believe it.
I felt like that was always an expression of Sorkin sexism, that like no one's mother matters.
Yeah.
What is the West Wing if Sorkin goes to therapy first?
The Obama White House?
Well, on that note.
I think that's our
show. Jeff hates that. He hates that I just said that. He hates it.
Me?
Yeah, you sighed. You wanted to like argue with me.
No, I didn't want to. I mean, like, I guess all TV shows don't exist if all the characters have a really good therapy experience. Like, yeah. That's right? Yeah. Like, that's...
I'm not saying I want that. Yeah, it's just a question. Yeah, yeah.
The scenes of... Someday, Rebecca, we'll have to do like a bespoke episode with all the scenes of therapy in the West Wing, which is an interesting scene of contention. I don't have any sense of... Is this romanticized therapy? Everything's romanticized.
When he just like kind of sits there and lets them talk.
Yeah.
That's true.
I guess so. Elliot Gould solves PTSD in a day? Is how that happens? Is that what that happened in that scene, in that episode? I can't figure that out. Anyway. Well, thank you guys. Very, very
thank
enjoyable.
You.
Always. Clearly, we could do this for a million years, and maybe we will. Talk to everyone later.
Bye.
What's next?